told the students of Bar-Ilan that we've opened up this class today for alumni. I actually see a number of alumni over here. I won't embarrass you all, but I see you. And we opened it up for other people as well that wanted to learn this topic. So let us begin. If you have questions, you'll either text me along the way, or you will. I'll give you time at the end to ask questions as well. So this year is not like every other year, right? Why is this Pesach different from every other Pesach? So I think most of us understand that. And with this Pesach, a number of questions have come up, and a number of suggestions have come up. Some of them, by the way, I just want to start off and express what I think. Occasionally, we have situations where people have agendas. And by the way, this sometimes is conscious, sometimes it's subconscious. But there are things which is the way that they, it's what they process. And I'll try to be much clearer about what I'm saying right now. So, for example, when some rabbis are asked about, oh, why did this happen? So you can have some rabbis, no matter what happens, they're going to say, it's because of, now you can fill in the blank, it's because of Lashon Hara, it's because women aren't sneered. By the way, it's always the women, by the way. They've never said because men aren't sneered enough, because the women aren't sneered enough. They'll say it's because people are doing this. And I'll say, 9 out of 10 times, if not more than that, there is this prepared answer, and then God is kind and gracious and provides some type of opportunity so that they can then say this thing which they then believe is the issue at hand, and therefore say, you see, God is doing this, and that's the message of God. And I'm not aware, and I'll paraphrase that one of my teachers, Rav Lichtenstein, said, I'm not aware of any of them having a direct contact with God where he informed them that this is what he was thinking. So, as I said, it's somewhat frustrating on the one hand that people know exactly what it is that God wants, but I'll say, this is a thought process, it's a mindset, it's prepared, and they just respond when the situation arises. On the other hand, there are people who every year will say things like, oh, you know, to me personally, or they'll say generally, or be all over social media, so when are the rabbis going to allow the Ashkenazim to eat kidney out? By the way, that's very interesting. The reason why they want Ashkenazim to eat kidney out is, by the way, more than anything else, is because Sfardim eat kidney out. Now, if Sfardim eat kidney out, then how can I not eat kidney out? Because there must be something which is really, you know, it's not fair. How can I not get everything? Well, different people have different customs. And along the way in those discussions, which, by the way, we've had much less of them this year, but they've been there as well. Could be they're not even bothering asking. But a number of people have said to me, in this situation, the way that it is this year, are the rabbis just going to allow kidney out? Okay, so I'll say that again. People have asked me about kidney out and want us to allow it. I mean, I've had people come over and say, Rabbi, allow kidney out. It'll make you famous, right? It'll make you big. You get so many followers. This could be a great career move. So if anybody wants to give advice, or now you realize my career has never taken off because I've never made the right career moves, so you can tell me later. We'll have a vote on it. We'll decide what I'll allow, what I won't allow. And by the way, I know how to allow it, which maybe is even more frustrating and more mysterious. But it's nonetheless, it's this prepared response that people have. You have to allow the kidney out in this, and other people a little bit further off. Well, maybe you shouldn't have 2 days of chag. But so for any women who are single right now, if you want to eat kidney out, marry Sephardi. It's very, very simple. If there's anybody who wants to keep 1 day of chag, so come and move to Israel, I'll allow you to keep 1 day of chag. Those of you who know me know that I even allow people to keep 1 day of chag if they come to visit Israel. I think that that's also okay. But my point is that just like you have people on the one hand have their prepared reasons that God has told them everything, you have other people with prepared things that they want to start, you know, crossing off of Jewish practice or change. And as I said, I understand, I'm a little sympathetic, not all that much. On the other hand, I don't know how many hands we have so far. On the other hand, there is absolutely good reason this year for us to be lenient on certain things, and when those things arise, then we will deal with them. For example, if somebody bought a brand new pot and under normal circumstances they would take it to the mikveh because it was bought, it was owned by a non-Jewish store, and they'll take it to a mikveh before they would use it, and that's the Jewish practice. In this year, many of you will tell me that that is not practical, it's not really safe, it's not a very good idea, and I'll agree with you. And then we'll have to find a solution for that. So one solution, which rabbis have suggested, is to sell it to a non-Jew. And a number of different websites I can direct you to have forums that you can sell your new kelim, your new utensils, to a non-Jew. And therefore, again, you'll be able then to use it. You sell it during the Chag, and afterwards you reacquire it. And then you, when you have a chance, you'll be able to take it to the mikveh and do what you're supposed to do. As far as kitniot goes, I'll be very straightforward and honest about this. If somebody's going to tell me that because of the current situation, they are worried about the nutrition that they will be able to take in, so I'm willing to entertain the various possibilities of what Ashkenazim would be allowed to eat. And there is ample historical precedent for this. On the other hand, it could well be that in modern society we don't have a problem about nutrition, which means the average person could get very good nutrition. Again, assuming that the store is delivering food. If somebody's going to call me or contact me Erev Chag and say, listen, I just couldn't get food. The only thing that I have in the house is I have 3 matzot, I have a bottle of wine, and I have hummus and rice and so on. So if that's all that they have in the house, obviously my answer will be very different. But this really comes down to a question of nutrition. Most of us can get some vegetables, meat and potatoes, and you can live that way for a week, probably even thrive that way for a week. So as I said, I'm not prepared to give an extreme answer based upon an extreme situation. It depends. Just because there's a health risk out there doesn't necessarily translate that therefore the correct solution should be that everyone should be allowed to kidney out. On the other hand, when somebody contacted me about their daughter who has had in the past eating issues, and today she considers herself to be vegan, and those of you who know me know that I consider all vegetarians and vegan to have eating disorders, and or a way to hide their eating disorders. So in this case, actually, she has an eating disorder, and she's vegan, and she's nursing. And I was questioned regarding what can she eat. So she can't eat the meat and potatoes. She can't eat the meat, at least. Potatoes, yes. That I described earlier. So I think in such a case, there is room for leniency. And again, based on a conversation with them, there are things that I would absolutely be lenient in, again, going further in terms of the kidney out. Okay, so let's leave that aside again and go back to other kinds of situations. Anybody who's watching live right now on Zoom knows that Zoom has become very, very famous. The two things, that I don't know if this is politically correct, but two things that have come from China are, apparently this virus started in China, and Zoom also came from China. That, now, maybe some of you will think there's a conspiracy, but go look and see who owns Zoom and what his background was. But Zoom is something we all should have bought stock in a long time ago. It really did quite well. And the question then became, a month ago, can we listen to Megillat Esther over Zoom? And my answer, by the way, I don't know if any of you ever asked me, but my answer to that is yes, I think that you could. Even though when it came to a rabbinic source about blowing the shofar, he says you couldn't listen to the echo of the shofar. The shofar is different. There you have to actually hear the sound. When it came to reading the Megillah, you had to hear the content. So I believe that if somebody was showing it over Zoom, you can hear the content, and I believe that that was okay. And there were a number of sources that I believe supported this. And as I said, that was and is my thought. And therefore, Zoom is in everybody's mind. Zoom in terms of religious fulfillment of commandments. And then became this wonderful question. Well, if the schools have shut down and the universities have shut down and everybody now is just watching and doing this over Zoom, so then perhaps we could allow a Passover Seder to be taking place over Zoom. So, and some of you may know that there was a group of rabbis who actually signed off on this. They identified themselves. They signed it. Although I will tell you that two of them claimed that they did not sign it. So that makes it interesting, which could be for a couple of reasons. One is they never signed it, and the other possibility is they signed it, and then they had some regret, they had some pressure on them, and decided to back down. I don't know which one is true, and it doesn't concern me right now which one is true. A number of rabbis signed it, and when I saw the names, I was not surprised whatsoever, because there was actually one name that I thought was the main name involved over there, which to me was important, and I'll come back and I'll explain this a little bit more in another moment. The reason that they felt this could be done is because ostensibly you're not breaking any kind of law. All that you do is you leave it running beforehand. It, as you see, works, and the people on the two ends of the video are able to watch one, or two ends of the computer can watch one another, and they can share the Pesach Seder with one another. And again, at face value, this sounds like a wonderful idea, a wonderful thing, because you're not doing anything. So you haven't broken the law at all. The problem with this is that it's not as obvious that it's okay the way that they described it. But the truth is, I don't want to get involved now in the nitty-gritty of the halacha. And I'll explain that, because my approach actually really, in a certain sense, sidesteps the question of electricity. But I want to be very honest about electricity. Electricity today is not necessarily the same problem that electricity posed 100 years ago. Then again, most rabbis writing 100 years ago did not necessarily understand how electricity worked. Which means when electricity was first, I don't know what word you want to use, discovered or invented, the question became immediately, just one second, Ariel, you have a question? So I'll try to deal with it soon. When electricity was first discovered, invented, most rabbis did not have the knowledge to really analyze it properly, to know exactly what it is, how it works, and so on. One who actually did understand quite well was the Chazon Ish, and the Chazon Ish felt that at least on Shabbat, the use of electricity would be a particular violation of a Torah law. That does not necessarily follow over to Chag, but in the case of the Chazon Ish, it did. Full stop. There was a rabbi, I hope you know his name, of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. He made his reputation, actually, on the first book that he wrote, which was called Ma'orei HaEsh, which he wrote about electricity. And as a young man, he took on the Chazon Ish, and he said that the Chazon Ish's understanding was not complete, and he argued with how it works. And again, a whole nother approach of how it worked. There were some Sephardic rabbis, not only the Aruch HaShulchan and others, who believed that fundamentally that electricity is not the same as fire. So when Torah says you can't light fire on the Shabbat day, they felt that this was just not fire. And let's add another element to it. On Chag, I'm allowed to light one fire from an existing fire. So when I turn an electric switch, am I creating a new fire, or am I simply transferring a fire? So there were a number of Sephardic rabbis, I'm saying especially Sephardic rabbis, who believed that this was allowed, and there were those who conducted themselves that way on the Chag. That opinion, for the most part, in the latter part of the 20th century, became forgotten. It became outvoted, it became pushed aside, and it did not become the dominant approach. One of the rabbis who did take this approach was a man known as Rabbi Shulush. He was the rabbi of Netanya, Rabbi David Shulush. And if you want, I can send you the links to his various responses, Shilot V'Tshuvot. They are fascinating. But there's also somewhat of a response over here. And that's why I want you to understand the response and what he's responding to. And then we'll have a larger picture, and then I'll get to the very essence of the topic. Rav Avadya Yosef, who I believe undoubtedly was the greatest Sephardic posek of the 20th century, and if some want to make an argument the greatest posek of the 20th century, they can make such an argument, but certainly the greatest Sephardic posek of the 20th century, he tried to create a situation that all Sephardim would follow his approach. Actually, he would have been happy if everybody followed his approach, but certainly if all Sephardim do. Now, there were other customs. There were the customs of Jews from North Africa, there were the customs of Jews in Morocco, in different places in Morocco, in North and South, and East and West, and towns, and so on. There were places customs in Iran and Iraq and Syria and so on and so forth. And Aleppo and Damascus, they had different customs. And Rav Ovadia tried to establish one custom. And his custom, or one halakha, and his halakha was what he called Maran. Maran is the Beit Yosef of Yosef Karo, and he said he was the Mara D'Atra, the ruler, the halachic ruler of Eretz Yisrael, and therefore now that we've all gathered and lived in Eretz Yisrael, everybody should follow Maran, everybody should follow Rav Yosef and Rav Yosef Karo, or he would have said the other way around, everyone should follow Rav Yosef Karo and Rav Yosef. And he says that's basically what his understanding of halacha is, whatever it was that Maran said, except for the times that he doesn't, because there are, of course, in all areas of law, there's always going to be the exceptions. But that was essentially the approach of Rav Ovadia. Now, was it fair? I can't even begin to judge, say, yes, it's fair, it's not fair. That was Ovadia's approach. As a young man, when he was 17 years old, he lost his first job because he taught the Ben Ish Chai, and he told the congregants every time the Ben Ish Chai was wrong because he went against Maran. So they fired him. How can you go against the Ben Ish Chai? Because this was a community that had come originally from the place of the Ben Ish Chai. So how can you go against the Ben Ish Chai? Rav Ovadia did. Rav Ovadia had a great deal of confidence in his approach, as I'll say it again, as a very young man. So, and by the way, Rav Ovadia would not mind if Ashkenazim followed the same approach. So therefore, any Ashkenazi who does want to eat kitniot, all that you have to do say, I follow Maran, I follow the Beit Yosef, he is the Mara D'Atra of Eretz Yisrael, I follow him in everything, I am no longer an Ashkenazi. See, my point is, I can't allow Ashkenazim to eat kitniot. Why can't I? Because it's the custom of Ashkenazim not to eat kitniot. That's our custom. But I could say, just like it would happen very often in history, how long do you wait between milk and meat? So it really depends on where your family came from, for the most part. There are places that people kept 6 hours and 5 hours and 4 hours and 3 hours, and some places even kept 1 hour. That, by the way, is the Holy Grail. And we'll go back to the Shidduch issue. The easiest people to get to Shidduch are probably Jews who come from Denmark who only wait 1 hour, right? They should have, like, absolutely their pick. Rabbi Clapper is smiling. They should absolutely have their pick in terms of Shidduchim because it's only 1 hour, correct? But what happened if you, 400 years ago, your family lived in Germany, or let's say lived in Poland and moved to Germany, would you switch and keep 3 hours? Yeah, probably pretty likely. What happens if along the way you, it's Holland and not Denmark? I don't know. I think it's Denmark as well, not just Holland. What happens, at least I know someone from Denmark who thinks that they follow the customs from Holland. Anyway, if you moved at some point to Amsterdam, then you would end up going down and especially, that's it. It was where you lived which really dictated what your custom was. It wasn't until really after, I'm not sure if I'll say after the Holocaust, but it was after there were massive movements of people where people kept their own customs instead of following the local custom. But Rav Ovadia would say, and he has said, if you travel, move to Eretz Yisrael, you follow the Maran, you follow the Beit Yosef, you follow the Machaber and everything, so now you have... It's not that I can allow an Ashkenazi not to kidney out, I can allow an Ashkenazi to become something else. You've moved, now you've become something new, now you've become this new thing, which is a Ben Eretz Yisrael. If you can ask me honestly, I think within 100 years, probably less, I think that 90% of Ashkenazim will become, in Israel at least, will become B'nai Eretz Yisrael. I think especially as families tend to quote-unquote intermarry between Ashkenazim and Sephardim. I think very few will keep their own customs, and there will be this merger that will take place, and this new reality will be created, and it will be this reality of B'nai Eretz Yisrael. That's my personal prediction. But again, if somebody tries to push it, it most likely will fail and they'll be attacked, but it happens in this more natural way. Then, we're as funny as this sounds, in terms of halacha, Jews believe in evolution, not in other areas. Jews believe in evolution and not revolution. Revolution tends to fail, but evolution tends to be much more successful. So, Rav Ovadia has this, we follow Maran, and therefore we got rid of all the other Sephardic customs, and rabbis from North Africa, and especially the ones who signed in this, Moroccans, said, Mat pitom, what are you talking about? We allow certain things. We allow the use of fire on, or the use of electricity, because it's like using an existing flame. And what's the problem with lighting a fire? What is the problem with using electricity on Chag? So I'll say it again. These rabbis would argue, at least some of them would argue, that not only can I use fire, I can put on the computer, I can put on Zoom, I could then put it on the other hand, and therefore there's no problem whatsoever because we're dealing with the Chag. that would be the argument. I could put it off afterwards as well. So, or most likely, well, it could be a different issue. But they're saying this is their understanding of halacha. Rav Shalush, who I mentioned earlier, who I've read through many of his tshuvot, Rav Shalush wrote a whole chapter on the history of halacha and claims that the Maran Beit Yosef was never the Maran D'Atra of Eretz Yisrael. He never was the opinion that people followed in Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, what he's doing is he's attacking Rav Avadia's entire thesis that today we follow we follow the Beit Yosef. He said, why should we follow him today? We never followed him before. How can you possibly say that he is the Maran D'Atra, the ruler of Eretz Yisrael? Every single community can and should continue to follow the customs of that community. That was the approach of Rav Shalush. So therefore, when I see Rav Shalush's son sign off on this thing that you can use Zoom on Chag, there's no surprise whatsoever, because he's simply following his family custom, he's following his father's ruling, and he believes that this is the correct approach for at least some Sfardim, and therefore he says, why do I have to follow anybody else? And we'll continue and just place that on aside for a moment. I want to pause again. There are extreme situations which are in front of us right now. I'll go in order. And I'm not kidding about this. For some people, the extreme situation is they have to make Pesach for the first time. You can have a family who's gone away to a hotel every single year for the last 30 years. They've never made Pesach. So for them, this is an extreme situation. They've never made Pesach before. I've gotten questions from people in the last couple of weeks. I've never made Pesach. I have no idea what to do. I have no idea what to do. How do I kosher? What do I do? Just, I've never made Pesach before. So I'm not belittling that. That's a serious situation. Somebody who never, by the way, you can have somebody who, God forbid, lost their job, is stuck at home, is not going away, and now has to start spending money on new plates, new things, new pots, new everything, and they have no idea what they're doing in terms of Pesach. So I'm saying that's not a very simple situation, and rabbis need to be able to address that. So, and maybe we need to, not maybe, we need to be lenient in certain things that on a normal year we haven't been. More than that, you can have people, in this, I got a question, you know, right 20 minutes ago or so, right before I started, somebody saying that they have a child in Israel and they were supposed to be with a relative and they can't go to the relative. And now they're looking at a Pesach all alone. Okay, a single girl all alone for Pesach. She can't go to any place. She has no idea what to do and she has anxiety. Okay, that's a very serious question. So, okay, so now how do you proceed? How do you continue? There are going to be people who, look, my parents years ago when they moved to Israel gave away all their Pesach dishes. They gave away all their Pesach pots. They said, we're never making Pesach again. We have four married children here. We have so many grandchildren that we can go to. Their difficulty would be to figure out who they're going to in a given year, and maybe they'll just go to a hotel one year because they don't have to make Pesach anymore. So guess what? My parents haven't left their home since Purim time, and they're making Pesach for the first time in 20-something years. They're making Pesach, and just the two of them are going to be there. But what about my neighbor's mother, who's never made Pesach on her own since her husband was alive and had all the kids were by their house. And since then, the kids got married. They would go to one of the kids, and now her husband passed away. And now she has to make Pesach all by herself, sit in a room all by herself. And she is a cancer survivor, and she has a compromised immune system. And she'll be sitting all by herself. And her kids are asking, well, why can't I leave Zoom on? Why can't I, you know, communicate with my mother? Why does my mother have to be all alone? And by the way, and that's in Israel. What about in America, where they're still punished for their being there, and they have 2 days of Chag, and they have 2 days of Chag, and then they have Shabbat, and now you have somebody who's all by themselves for 3 days in a row? That's not a very simple situation. And rabbis need to be able to deal with this. So I do want to stress that situations of anxiety, situations of depression, situations where we really fear for somebody's well-being is something which has to be dealt with as an extreme situation, but has to be dealt with. But that's part of what I want to speak about in terms of approach. I'm not going to get up and say that because of a certain cases of extreme situations, across the board, we need to be lenient in every situation. That's not how halacha works. Which means there are individual rulings which rabbis need to give for individual cases, but then you need big rabbis to create precedent and law for how a community behaves. That's not the same. I'm going to say that again. you have halacha with a big H and halacha with a small H. Halacha with a big H, and I just want to thank a friend and a colleague of mine, Rabbi David Lappin, who we had a little bit of a discussion about this, and I thought he said this beautifully. He said that when it comes to establishing halacha, that needs to be world-class rabbis. In terms of giving rulings of halacha, that's going to be rabbis of communities and rabbi teachers and rabbis of schools are going to give rulings, but that's not the same thing as establishing halacha. Which means, in order to be that person who's going to get up and establish and say that everybody can use Zoom because some people are in distress or depression, that's not going to be a very fair statement. Which means you literally need the top rank to be able to do this. And I also, again, want to be careful. I don't want to take the situation where the extreme situation becomes the mainstream situation. You know, it's interesting that today, when we look at halacha, we follow the Babylonian Talmud with, I would say, infinitely more value than the Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud. One of the reasons that it's given, there's a lot of different reasons given. One of the reasons that's given is that Yerushalmi lived under extreme situations, and some of the laws that were created were extreme laws to deal with extreme situations, and therefore it wasn't valid as precedent for non-extreme situations. So I'm saying that's a really, I see Michael shaking his head. Michael, wonderful to see you. I see Michael shaking his head and agreeing with me on this. That is one of the reasons. So therefore, if someone's going to go and give an extreme ruling right now, extreme rulings don't work as a precedent to try to create mainstream, although sometimes it does work. But it works because of all kinds of other factors as well. Because normally when something extreme happens, there's going to be pushback. So let me go back to the situation as well, which means what would happen theoretically if I were to say everybody can use Zoom this year. So again, I have to be really honest with how much impact I really have. I assume some people would follow me. A lot of people don't even know who I am would follow. Oh, Rabbi Ari Kahn, who is he? You ever followed him before? No, but he said it, so it must be okay. So why? Because what they want to hear. And I assume that there'll be certain people who would do it continually off into the future. And by the same token about Kitney Out and any other thing they wanted to do. They want to keep one day, want to keep Kitney Out, right? And all the other things they wanted to do. Some rabbi says it's okay, so that's great, as long as, you know, they're able to sleep at night. And if you say what they want to hear, I would presume they'll be able to sleep at night. So let me try that all over again. I do believe that for a ruling that to be given, it has to be given by the top, the elite, in terms of the rabbis. If you want, I can give you names who I think that they are today. And those are the people who really have to be the ones. Rav Asher Weiss, for example, I think he's one. If he gets up and says it's okay, then it will be accepted almost automatically by 50% of Orthodox Jews. But I don't believe Rav Asher Weiss is going to say it. If second or third or fourth tier people say it, it's not the same. By the way, even if the arguments are wonderful, it's just not the same in terms of something which becomes a new application of law. Which goes back now to, I want to get to the essence of the issue. We're actually going to learn a little bit and not just have me talk. And maybe you think you've been learning. And I want to look at some sources. There is, let's see if I find, yes. And I sent on the chat, I sent a note if anybody wants to look at the sources. And let's take a look over here. There's Gemara, which some of people learning Daf Yomi probably saw pretty recently. The Gemara talks about putting things in motion before Shabbat. And one of the things is, can I leave my hose on, which will water the field? And yeah, it says you can do it. One of the things that it says along the way over here is that it says, Aval, however, einot mchitin l'toch harechayim, shomayim, ele b'chdei sh'yitachanu mi'bo'od yom. You should not be putting wheat inside the mill, only stuff for that day. My time, what's the reason? Amar Rabba, and the Gemara is going to give us two reasons. Rabba says, b'mei shemashmat kol, because it makes noise. Rav Yosef says, shouldn't the real reason be over here? Because a person's kelim, the utensils, should also rest on Shabbat. So we essentially have two different opinions here, but I want to go to Rashi, because Rashi is significant in source number two. Rashi says, Berechem Shemayim, and he goes other types of mills that will be used to animals, because animals can't work. You have to, your animal needs to rest as well. That is Aseret HaDibrot. Because it makes noise. We're going to see some applications of this in a moment. And then Rashi also adds a second thing, ve'ika ziluta, and it causes cheapness, cheapening of Shabbat. So Rashi said two things. I can't, according to Rashi, okay, stay with me, I can do a number of things, I can set a number of things in motion before Shabbat, but something that I can't do is something which will make noise, and the second thing that I can't do is something which will cause the Shabbat to be cheapened. Of course, you can now ask me, well, first of all, there were two opinions in the Gemara. One was the opinion of Rabbah, the other was of Yosef. One said it's because your kelim need to rest, the other is because, apparently, because it's going to make noise or Shabbat will be cheapened. Which one of these opinions are law? So, as is often the case, there is a machloket about this. According to, again, let me go down there, according to one opinion, let's look at Tosfot, it says, Amar Rabbeinu Tam, the Hilchotik of Yosef. He says the law is the Reich of Yosef, and the problem is that you need to have your Kelim need to rest on Shabbat. What the implications of that is, I'm going to leave off on the side, and then Tosfot tells us afterwards, Ve'it le hashmat kol kiraba, and some say that the law is because of noise, Ve'chein pasak harach, Rabbeinu Chananel, and I'll again let you know that there are numerous Rishonim on both sides of this argument. The Mechaber of Yosef Karan, the Shulchan Aruch, writes, "Umutar l'teit chitim l'toch rechaim shamayim." Some of the chashecha, you're allowed to put it in, and the Rama explains the Mechaber and says, "But lo chashin l'ashmat kol." We're not so worried about that. Why? Because people will understand it. Shoyom rechaim shaploni tochenet b'Shabbat. Right? What is it? I follow. Right? V'lochashin l'ashmat kol shoyom. But we're not worried that people are going to say, "Oh, that this guy's working on Shabbat." But the Rama adds, "V'yesho simurichaim." And some people do say that you're not allowed to do it. He then adds, "V'hochi nahog lechadchila," and that is the normal case. Will be b'makom pseida yesh lahakel. But in some cases where there'll be a loss, you're allowed to be lenient. Of course, the question is, what is a loss? Now, based on this teaching so far, if I were to ask you, am I allowed to, for example, to have my dishwasher go on at 3 o'clock in the morning, assuming that everything about it is okay, it's on the own Shabbat, it's on the Shabbat clock, I don't do anything, I don't have to do anything, I just put it in and it will work by itself, but it's going to make noise. Well, the truth is, the amount of noise it's going to make, no one's going to notice, no one's going to know, there's no problem. It's not it's not like a mill, and I don't believe there's a problem with this whatsoever. However, Rav Moshe Feinstein, who, again, you know, when I said before that there are rabbis and there are rabbis, and I qualified that Rav Ovadia may have been the greatest Sephardic posek, well, I think the greatest Ashkenazi posek of the 20th century was Rav Moshe Feinstein. And Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked a question which directly impacts what we just now read, which will also impact our question. He was asked, we'll see how it was posed in a second. He's asked as follows. Ta'amea isur l'davar l'daber b'microphone. The reasons that you cannot talk into a microphone on Shabbat v'Yom Tov. This question was from 1969, and he tells who asked the question. From the answer, we understand that the person asking the question had a job in a shul that had a microphone. If he uses the microphone, he keeps his job. Remember the Rama said that things that were machmir not to make noise unless there's going to be a loss, Seda, we're going to lose something. So this is a pretty good question. Can I make noise? If not, I'm going to lose my job. So that seems to be a pretty good reason. So Rav Moshe then goes off and he tells you many reasons why this is not allowed. He goes, "V'davar l'daber b'shabbat et microphone pashut sha'aser." It's simple to me. It's not allowed. V'kvar pisamu agudat rabbanim sha'aser, and the organization of rabbis got together and said it's not allowed. Which means, why are you asking me anymore? You know it's not allowed. V'af she'ika inshi shelo yadua lahem ha'ta'amim u'chuyavim lishmo l'ratam ha'chachamim. And even those who don't understand why it's not allowed have to listen to rabbis. V'otan she'ikilu, and those who were lenient in this, lo asu kol good, they were not proper. Afim him rabbanim, even if they're rabbis. V'afim omim shehim gedolim b'torah, and even if some people say or claim that these people are great scholars. And I want to explain this a little bit historically. Many or not most conservative shuls back in the 50s, 60s, 70s had microphones. There were Orthodox shuls that did as well. That was not necessarily the distinction between Orthodox and conservative. But the Orthodox rabbis who argued it was okay, they had their arguments. And Rav Moshe is saying that it's not allowed. It's simple that it's not allowed. the vast majority have decided it's not allowed, and even if some people have argued that it is allowed, there was one fairly famous rabbi who wrote a whole argument why he thought it was allowed at the time. Rabbi Soloveitchik responded, and he said that those who thought it was allowed, there were only two things that they didn't know. Right? He said if they knew two things, then they would not have come to that conclusion. One thing, he said, was how a microphone actually works. And the second thing, he said, if they knew, Hilchot Shabbat. So he claims that the people who allowed this were simply ignorant, both in terms of technology and in terms of Shabbat. And I do want to qualify, again, the challenge of electricity today is not the same challenge as it was 50 years ago. Electricity has changed. The challenge, by the way, is much greater because the problems are probably much easier, which means to be lenient today is probably easier than it was to be lenient years ago, which actually is going more to the point of what my argument is going to be about this. Before I continue with Rav Moshe and what he said, again, he just said it's not allowed. Maybe I'll read a little bit more about what he said. V'aver b'kitzur t'tamim shem shnayim. He goes, on the one hand, I'm concerned that there may be a Torah law being broken. And then there's certainly rabbinic problems. And he says that that talking creates some kind of an impression, electronic impression. He goes, I think that there's a Torah law being broken. It creates some kind of a wave, if you will. Even though it's not writing in the sense that it wrote letters, it created something new. So he said, I think it's like writing. Maybe it's like writing, maybe it's like something called maka bepatish, finishing something, or maybe it's like creating something. Rav Moshe just now threw out a bunch of different reasons why he thinks that you may have broken a Torah law by using a microphone. And he goes, okay, I'm sure it's one of them, and I have to give some thought to figure out which one it is. I'll call upon him Tamzehu Lachush the Isur Deraita. He goes, and that's because I'm concerned that there may be a Torah law of Shalibur Isur, even if I don't know what it is. And then later on, he writes in Gimel, Kevin Shbacholo La Devar Lachaber the microphone. Second, Lachain Af Im Lohaya Shum Isur Beetzma Devar Asur Zumidur Banan, Measha Asuli Tain Chitin Latoch Rechaim Shamayim, Bear of Shabbat. He says, but it's just like the case we learned from the Gemara. It's like putting the wheat in the mill. And it's going to work on Shabbat. He goes on, he says, Umitamza asur lamid be'erev Shabbat radio v'television, or televisia, k'dei lerot lushmo b'Shabbat. He says, for the same reason, if you've ever wondered where this came from, that you can't leave your radio on, or you can't leave your television on, Rav Moshe says it comes from this idea. Now, watch what he does, because it's going to go back to this Rashi that we saw. On the one hand, the rabbi, there's a rabbinic law against using musical instruments, and he just now considered a microphone to be a musical instrument, and a radio and a television. To afet a microphone, yuchlim kimat rov ben adam letaken, because if something goes wrong, most people can fix it. So therefore, the same problem that you may come to fix it, he says, this is a problem. And he'll finally say, maybe I skipped it when he said it, that this will also cause what we would call ziluta de Shabbat. It's going to cause Shabbat to be taken with less seriousness. One second. Before I come out, perhaps that's in the other tshuva, he says, sorry, in the other tshuva, he says it's stronger, so wait on that for a second. Ulechin berush a microphone asur l'shtamesh bo b'shabbat v'yom tov, ve'ein lakel af l'tzarech gadol. And therefore, you can't use the microphone whatsoever, even for a great reason. Ulechin asur l'malet kvodo. Therefore, the rabbi who asked me, can l'kabel misra kezu, you cannot take this job, should starech l'daber al yidei microphone b'shabbat v'yom tov. You can't use it because this is considered to be either breaking the Torah law or breaking the rabbinic law. But I want to go back and I want to give another argument, which maybe is not as obvious to us. And I'm going to just point a little bit to some sources, but first let me explain the background. Are you allowed to keep your store open on Shabbat? The store. I own a store. Can I keep my store open on Shabbat? So what's the answer? Well, all of you know the answer is no. My question is why? Where does it say you can't? We know there are 39 different things you can't do on Shabbat. Is I can't plant and I can't plow and I can't harvest and I can't, all kinds of things I can't do. Keeping a store open is not on that list of 39 things. The closest you can get to it is if you kept your store open, then someone will come in and someone will want to buy something, and maybe I'll take a pen and write it down or make a contract. Which means just like I can't use a utensil because maybe I'm going to come to fix it, I can't do business because maybe I'm going to write it down. And that seems a little far-fetched. Which means there's no Torah law being broken over here. So why is it so serious to keep my store open? The Ramban creates, or I don't want to say creates because that's wrong. He's going to tell us why I can't keep the store open. But actually, there was somebody who beat the Ramban to it. And we need to know who it was. It was a rabbi who made up a prohibition to keep your stores open. So who was this rabbi? He was actually very prominent, and all of you have heard of him. And the only problem is you never thought of him as being a rabbi, because his name is Yeshayahu, source number 9. Im tashiv mi Shabbat raglecha, sot chafatzecha biyom kodshi. Give it a rest on Shabbat, and don't go and doing your things on my holy day. Don't go talking on Shabbat about things you want to Torah. Don't go doing your stuff on Shabbat. The idea of closing your store on Shabbat comes from these verses in Yeshayahu. Rather, as titanag al Hashem, you should have oneg Shabbat. Don't do mivtzo cheftzacha. Daber davar, don't go doing your things on Shabbat. The Ramban, who is obviously much later, and this will be in source number 8, which is the Ramban in Perek Kaf Gimel, mainly Pasuk Kaf Dalet, and also in his Drasha, which is source number 10, for Rosh Hashanah. And those of you who really want to understand this topic properly, you need to read this entire Ramban. I'm not going to read the entire thing, but he's going to tell us that both on Shabbat and Yom Tov, look at the beginning of source number 8, it's talking about Kaf Gimel, Pasuk Kaf Gimel said, V'deber Hashem al Shelemor, Daber B'nei Yisrael, Leimor B'chodesh HaShvi'i B'chod L'chodesh, that's Rosh Hashanah, Yelechem Shabbaton, Zichron Torah Mikra Kodesh. What is Shabbaton? What does it mean to have a Shabbat on Rosh Hashanah? So the Ramban explains, Yelechem Shabbaton, Shia Yom Shvita, it should be a day of rest. And the rabbis understand in the Gemara that that is a positive commandment to rest on Shabbat. Anybody who works on Yom Tov broke the negative thing, but also the positive thing. Anybody who rests keeps a positive commandment. The Ramban's going to explain on Shabbat the same thing is true a little later on. Talmud Lomar Shabbaton, Shavut, it means to rest. Of a parish Shabbaton, kachu shetia lanu menucha min haTorah, va'omal kemo shebiyarnu v'unyan hagun v'tov b'mod. The Ramban is going to explain along the way that the rabbis are the ones who have to understand what is it that you can't do. V'nei huzhora malachot b'Shabbat b'lav onish karetu b'ita, v'atrochim v'mal ba'asei hazeh, u'v'yom tov malacha b'lav v'torech ba'asei. U'mimenu omar enavi, me'asot darkecha b'mitzeh chefzecha v'daver davar. And he goes back and he quotes the verses over here. So to stress this idea again, on Shabbat, there are things you can't do because it's breaking Shabbat. On Yom Tov, there are things you can't do because it's breaking Yom Tov. But there's also a positive idea. Shabbaton on Chag and Shvut, Yom Shvi Tishbot, to rest. But what is resting? So a couple hundred years, there was a rabbi. His name was Rav Moshe Sofer. He's known as the Chatam Sofer. And again, the Chatam Sofer in his day was the greatest posek in the world. By the way, just notice there's a theme over here. I mentioned Rav Avadia, I mentioned Rav Moshe. The Ramban was in his lifetime the greatest rabbi in the world. And now we get to the Chatam Sofer. None of these are people you never heard of. Yeshayahu as well was somebody of great significance. So what is it the Chatam Sofer said? He was asked, what if somebody keeps their store open on Shabbat? What is their status? So he wrote, if you keep your store open on Shabbat and you broke no Torah law, your status is one of a mechalel Shabbat b'farhesya, somebody who publicly desecrates Shabbat, and everything included or implied by publicly breaking Shabbat. Why? You didn't break it. You didn't do anything. I didn't necessarily write that contract. I just kept the store open. I have a non-Jew working for me in the store with me who takes the credit card and does all the work with the credit card. I didn't do anything. The Chatam Sofer says, based on this Ramban, based upon the Pasuk in the Torah, that you've broken or you have not fulfilled the positive commandment to rest on Shabbat, and consequently, what you have done is you are now a desecrator, which means there's two ways of desecrating. One way of desecrating is breaking one of the 39 commandments, breaking what you're not allowed to do. The other way is not doing the positive, not turning into a day of rest, which then creates the question, so, okay, what exactly is tantamount to a day of rest of Shabbat? And now I want to go back to Rav Moshe Feinstein one more time. Rav Moshe was asked about something which may surprise us. He was asked about something which is called a Shabbat clock. Can I keep a Shabbat clock? Right, by the way, the tshuva of Rav Moshe, of the Chatam Sof that I mentioned, is source number 11 over here, keeping the stores open. Again, if you have time, you can read through it, but I've told you his the main point. Not even breaking Shabbat, but not even breaking Shabbat, but not keeping Shabbat is considered breaking Shabbat. Rav Moshe, source number 12, was the microphone, so now go a little bit lower, and in source number 13, he's asked about a Shabbat clock. Am I allowed to use a Shabbat clock in order to put things on and off on Shabbat? Now, all of us do, so like, what kind of question is this? So we're going a couple of lines here. Hinei l'ni da'ati, pashut shasur. Certainly you can't. Latir zeh. Derei ayde moresh sha'ot, that is a sha'un Shabbat, something which will put things on and off, kizeh. Yuchlim nesot kol b'lachot b'shabbat, u'b'chol batei ha'rashot. Factories, that you when automation becomes more sophisticated, we will be having full automation in our houses. We'll have things going on and off. Ve'ein lacha zilzul gadol l'shabbat mizeh, and there's nothing going to be greater in terms of zilzul. Remember the Rashi that we quoted before? Why can't you have the noise on Shabbat? Because it's zilzul Shabbat. It desecrates the Shabbat. So he said, work going on in a Jewish home is going to desecrate the Shabbat. And he makes a fascinating argument. Had the rabbis of old known about a Sha'un Shabbat, a Shabbat clock, they would not have allowed it. Now, he's going to qualify, and he's going to say for certain things it can be used, especially for lights. And he says, but if the rabbis would not have allowed it, Kemosha Asru Amira La'akum, the same way that it didn't allow you to ask a non-Jew to do something on Shabbat, by the way, based on the same verse, Vidaber Davar, certain things you can't talk about. You can't say to a non-Jew, please do this thing for me on Shabbat. Bitam Zeh. V'gam Ulai Hu Memeila B'chlel Isur Zeh Dasru Amira La'akum. And maybe it's included when the rabbi said that a non-Jew can't do work for a Jew on Shabbat. It includes automation. Dasru Kol Melacha Na'aseit B'Shvil Yisrael. Because the rabbis disallowed anything done for a Jew. Mitzad Amira Yisrael, V'kolshke Mitzad Ma'aseh Yisrael. Certainly if I set it in motion by doing it. So his main argument over here is Zilut de Shabbat, if I go a little bit lower down. V'yishkam gadola asur mitam acher dehu Zilut de Shabbat. V'av Zilut de Yom Tov hu asru b'kama dvarim. V'kevin shabarur she'ikad Zilut de Shabbat hu b'chlel isur zeh. V'mela avshelo asru zeh b'yichud. D'kol inyan Zilut hu asur. So, let me go back and now explain. And again, he'll repeat himself and say this later on. Begamamela Lake is Ziluta, flights go on. He doesn't believe that's Ziluta. Now let me explain my thoughts, where I'm going with all this, and my conclusion as well. There's no question in my mind, if rabbis across the board allow anybody with a relative who's not with them to perform the Seder by Zoom, there's no question in my mind that on that same holiday or the next Shabbat, you will have hundreds if not thousands of people who will also use the computers because it's the same kind of thing. I can leave it on, I can use it. They're going to use the cell phones and they will use all kinds of things, which means you may question how I can accept Rav Moshe partially and not completely. Because you all know today that Rav Moshe was not accepted, and we use the Shabbos clock, as it's called, on an air conditioner. We use it on other things. Essentially, anything which is used in order to make more oneg Shabbat or make the Shabbat more enjoyable, we do. And now you're going to argue with me and say, but hold it a second. If my grandmother's by herself and us having to say it with her, there's no greater joy in terms of family being together. That's what Pesach is. It's family being together. And I appreciate that. And you can accuse me now of the proverbial slippery slope. And yes, this is the slippery slope. But I don't think it's slippery. I don't think it's a slope. I think it's going to be a direct response. I think that being lenient on this will destroy Shabbat as we know it. And I think that's what the great rabbis are ordered to do. Again, there are things you can't do on Shabbat. And most of the discussion in this letter, when the rabbis allowed, they said, oh, they're not really breaking Shabbat. They're not breaking Chag. They're leaving it on. And maybe even on Chag, you're allowed to push the button, and so on. All that I can accept. I'm not going to debate them on this. I'm debating a different point. We have a positive commandment on Chag and on Shabbat to turn it into a day of rest. Shabbaton. Turn it into a day of rest. If we lose Shabbat to cell phones, if we lose Shabbat to computers, we've lost Shabbat, we lost Chag. That's the only thing that makes it different today. What else is there? Which means this will directly contribute to a total break. Now, if there is an extreme situation, if there is somebody who's depressed, if there's somebody whose well-being we're really scared about, if somebody, you need to talk to them because of mental health issues, and I'm saying serious mental health issues, I'm willing to discuss that on an individual basis for the individual case. I don't believe that that's going to be a across-the-board issue. That's pikuach nefesh. Believe me, I get asked questions about pikuach nefesh all the time. As some of you know, I'm on the board of the rabbis of Zaka. I get asked life and death questions more often than you can possibly believe, and I know how to answer these questions. If something is life and death or potentially life and death, then we need to respond to it, and we need to respond to it appropriately. That doesn't tell you, of course, the board in every single case that we can create some type of a leniency, because I see where that will go. Two sides of Shabbat, two sides of Chag. One side is not to do the melacha. We can debate what the melacha is. The other side is to create a Shabbat day. Look what the Chatam Sofer did. Chatam Sofer right there saw, if he allows stores to stay open, and technically nobody broke Shabbat on a Torah level, but you keep the stores open, we would have lost Shabbat for that generation. That's it. And he said, no, we need to focus on the positive, focus on the Rabban, focus on Yeshayahu, focus on keeping the spirit of the day. Now, some of you can say, but it's just the spirit of the day, that's a minor point. No. The spirit of Shabbat or the spirit of Chag is a positive commandment that we have. And the way that I understand it, which I'm saying is based upon the Ramban, in every single generation, we need, rabbis need to look and to say, honestly, what do I need to do to make sure the spirit of the day remains, the kedusha of the day? So essentially, the tension that we have right here is a tension of those who are going to say that Simchat Chag, enjoying the Chag, family together on Chag, is the most important thing. There are others who are going to say, no, the most important thing is not the Simchat Chag, it's the Kedushat Chag. Now, obviously, in a perfect world, we need both. Obviously, in a perfect world, we need Kedushat Chag and we need Simchat Chag. The problem is, what's the price that we're going to pay one or the other? If the price we're going to pay is somebody's going to be alone, which can be a terrible or it could be an interesting experience, that's not an extreme price to pay. If 1 year we're not going to be with our grandparents, we're not going to be with our parents, not going to be with our grandchildren, okay, there's a price to pay. If somebody can convince me that there's a pikuach nefesh, literally, that there's a life and death situation going on, I will deal with that in every way that I know how, but that's the extreme case. I'm not going to make a ruling for the mainstream because of the extreme, because I think that the price is too great. I think that the price over here of losing Shabbat, of losing Chag, because that's what's going to happen. Don't kid yourself. Every single kid watching this is going to say, okay, there are ways I can leave a computer on. Why do you think it's going to be any different? Any kid watching is going to figure out a little bit later, so I can use my phone also. Texting is not really not allowed, because you're allowed to use, especially if you use this more extreme approach. Yeah, I'm allowed to text on Chag. As it is, we're fighting with people, I hope most of you know, that no, you're not allowed to text on Shabbat. No, you're not allowed to text on Chag. Why you can't, I'm not discussing right now. I'm not discussing if you broke a Torah law, rabbinic law, maybe a Torah law. That doesn't concern me right now. You know when that concerns me? That concerns me in a situation of extreme, then I want to know, okay, how do I bend the law to save the person in the extreme situation? That's part of what I need to do. But when I'm dealing with a mainstream situation, even if it's a dramatic mainstream situation, that the price is too great to pay. And therefore, you'll notice that most of the, I'm not going to rate the rabbis, but that's why most of the great rabbis today have not been able to possibly imagine that there's going to be, you know, of course the board allowed there to be Zoom. Yes, it's going to be an interesting Pesach. I don't know how many people are going to be sitting by my table. I mean, I'm assuming that there'll be four. I'll be seeing me, my wife, and two of our kids are going to be there. My married kids are not going to be coming, I believe. Maybe I'll be surprised. But again, this smaller family unit. And by the way, it's possible that two of my kids get stuck in Yerushalayim also and won't be able to make it home for whatever reason. It could be that just the two of us. So my parents are sitting. My father said to me today, so right now we're having, I asked him how he's doing. He said, we're on our second honeymoon. And then he paused. And he realized that when they got married in 1954, you can start doing the math and see how long my parents were married. He said, you know what? We never had a first honeymoon. He goes, this is our first honeymoon. So two people together. It's very, very nice. One person is stuck by themselves. Well, you know, think about it. It says that in the Haggadah. If a person has a child, they teach their child. And the children asks, Ma Nishtana. And if not, then husband and wife together ask, Ma Nishtana. Ask one to the other. But if the Gemara says, and if not, meaning if a person is by themselves, then he asks himself, Ma Nishtana. And it could be it's very, very different that night. But sometimes even having time alone can be very interesting, and sometimes even time alone can be something which is very rewarding. Is it optimal? No. We want to open our houses. Those of you who don't know, you can look at my Facebook or whatever. We put the mezuzah in our new house today. And we have a table there that we can open up, and we can have all the people that are watching right now. You can all sit by our table, and we can have Pesach together. So this is not the year that it's going to happen. Maybe another year it's going to happen. So we're going to have a nice big new house, Bezrat Hashem. The kitchen's kosher. It's brand new. Kitchen's completely kosher for Pesach. But it could be just the two of us. It could be the four of us. Okay, so that will be this year. Bezrat Hashem, everyone who's sick will be healthy. And Bezrat Hashem, nobody else will get sick. Bezrat Hashem, God will take care of us. And just as we say in Hebrew, Avarnu et Paro, Navor gam et zeh, and we'll be able to move on to the next stage. And we will. We will. Bezrat Hashem. But creating a Zoom Seder, in my mind, I think the price is too great. In my mind, we need, especially in this generation, to fight for Kedushat Hayom, to fight for the holiness of Shabbat, to fight for the holiness of Chag, along with all the other elements of Chag that we have, the beautiful food and the beautiful people and the beautiful Simcha. So maybe this year we'll have a little less Simcha. We have to work to make sure the Simcha, but we have to at least make sure that we have a great deal of Kedushah.